From WAMC in Albany, this is the Legislative Gazette, a weekly magazine about New York State government and politics. Your host is David Gustina, with political commentary by Dr. Alan Shartok, political scientist and professor emeritus at the University at Albany. Statewide distribution for the Legislative Gazette is made possible by New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org.
Coming up this week, lawmakers scramble to pass a budget before the April 1st deadline. Our political observer Alan Shartok shares his thoughts on Daily News reporter Ken Lovett being arrested in the Senate chamber lobby this week. And gunmaker Remington files for Chapter 11 bankruptcy with ties upstate. Those stories and more on the Legislative Gazette. New York lawmakers began passing budget bills, but there was still no deal on some of the major issues in the budget agreement by Friday morning. With the Passover and Easter holidays pushing lawmakers to agree before Friday night, a budget extender seemed to be increasingly likely before adjourning for the Easter holiday. More now from the Legislative Gazette's Karen DeWitt.
Senators emerged from a party conference after discussing what's in and what's out of the budget. Senator John Bonasick, who represents portions of the Hudson Valley, says education spending will likely be increased by over $1 billion. That's a higher amount than recommended by Governor Cuomo. It's still not known whether the governor will get his wish to have greater control over the exact school aid distributions for New York City schools and large school districts upstate, including Buffalo, Rochester, and Syracuse.
Do you know what the final school aid number was going to be? We heard $1 billion a few days ago.
I think it'd be a little higher.
A little higher than $1 billion?
A little higher, yeah.
Senator Jim Todisco from Schenectady says all of the new taxes proposed by Governor Cuomo are out of the budget, including a new tax on internet sales.
All the taxes are off, $1 billion in taxes. We're going to save the constituents a lot of money. That's the bad medicine we don't need. That's what caused the governmental malpractice to make us less competitive in this state.
But Todisco says the proposed 2 cents per milligram tax on prescription opioids might be included, but it will no longer be technically called a tax.
They're not calling it a tax, but stewardship. But that's the one thing that may be left.
Governor Cuomo has created two fixes to try to mitigate the partial loss of state and local tax deductions in the new federal tax overhaul. One would offer an optional employer payroll tax as an alternative to employees paying their state income taxes. Business owners would then pay the equivalent amount in taxes to the state, but they would still be allowed to deduct it from their taxes. The governor also wants to set up charitable trusts that property taxpayers could contribute to in lieu of paying their property taxes. They would then receive a deduction for the donation. Democrats in the Assembly have accepted Cuomo's plans largely intact, but some Republican senators are not on board, though they concede that they might end up in the budget anyway. Senate Deputy Majority Leader John DeFrancisco calls the payroll tax option an administrative nightmare and the charitable entities foolish and misleading.
They don't work, and there's nobody who could possibly believe that by creating trusts so people could pay their $5,423 of school taxes into a trust and automatically, magically become a charitable deduction. That's not a voluntary act. You're paying your school taxes.
Several items that Cuomo had tied to the budget are not currently in the spending plan, including the Child Victims Act for survivors of childhood sexual abuse, the DREAM Act, which would provide college aid for children of undocumented immigrants, and bail reform. A uniform policy for dealing with sexual harassment in state and local governments is still in the budget, though. The details are being finalized. DeFrancisco and the other senators say there's still a chance, though, that even what's been agreed to so far could fall apart and that budget extenders could be needed.
There's still some serious things that have to be decided, and if they're not decided within time to within sundown on Friday, then there's going to have to be an extender.
That's when Passover begins, followed by Easter. Senator Bonisik says there's talk of approving a one-month-long temporary spending bill to last until early May. But he says the threat of extenders can also provide impetus for warring sides to compromise before the time runs out on Friday.
It's the final chicken move where it's an extender or we get it done.
School districts immediately objected to a month-long budget extender. The New York State Council of School Superintendents says that school districts need to know how much they're getting in state aid by mid-April. They need to meet a state deadline of April 23rd for school boards to finalize the budget proposals. They'll go before voters on May 15th. In Albany, I'm Karen DeWitt.
Joining us now, Legislative Gazette political observer Alan Shartok. Well, Alan, as we just heard from our Karen DeWitt, the lawmakers in New York scrambling to get a budget passed by Friday night, which as we speak is hours away, and it looks increasingly like they'll pass a budget extender. However, we know what isn't in the budget. Things like this, Child Victims Act, voting reform, bail reform, and the DREAM Act all dropped in interest of passing the on-time nearly what looks like $168 billion plan. We also have been hearing that a pay raise may be in the offing.
Well, let's start with the pay raise. That's extraordinary. The last time we went through this, the governor quite properly said, okay, you guys, I'll give you a pay raise, but you're not allowed to make money on the outside. Because frankly, that's the way in which, for want of a better phrase, the legislators make out like bandits. Not all legislators, but a number of them do. And when you decide that you're going to come to a regular lawyer or a lawyer who happens to be a senator or an assemblyman, come on now, you'd have to be very, very naive not to understand what this is all about. That demand on the governor's part, which was rejected by the legislature for good reason because they were making out like bandits, is not here. The only thing he says is, I'm not giving you the pay raise unless you get the budget done on time. Come on. Governor, legislature, this is not right. We need ethics reform. This is a governor who said we were going to have ethics reform. He said so when he kicked off his campaign. He said so continually. Some of the people around him have shown just the opposite has been happening. The store was open for business. That was the Prococo verdict. So this is not a good idea. They deserve a raise, but they deserve it coupled with ethics reform. As for all the other stuff, the DREAM Act, the child victims, will you please stop? Don't tell me what you want, Governor and legislature. Tell me what you did, because everything else I call baloney. No question about that. And this business of saying you want something and then, we couldn't get it. We didn't. The Senate didn't agree with the Assembly. This governor, really, I'm sorry, has more ownership over that Republican state Senate. All he has to do is call foul, and they're out of there. But he won't do that. He hasn't done that yet. He does it, but there are those of us who think he doesn't mean it. And so that's what you're going to get in this corrupt, and I mean that maybe not in the most legal of senses, but in the most moral of senses, way in which these people do business.
Well, let's go from the budget to jail. We're talking about New York Daily News Albany Bureau Chief Ken Lovett, who was promptly arrested this week after a sergeant of arms in the Senate chamber lobby, while the Senate was not in session, told him he couldn't talk on his cell phone. Ensued sort of a kerfuffle between the two, even being asked to leave the chamber, which Ken wouldn't do. He gets taken, arrested, across the street. The governor comes over, even though he was already relieved, and pretends he's his pro bono lawyer.
Well, first of all, you have to understand that the relationship between Ken and the executive chamber has never been that good. So when Cuomo comes over to so-called get him out of jail, but apparently this had all been arranged. The Senate chief of the security system over there had come and said this was wrong and said there'll be no charges and let him out. And then the governor showed up. Some of the news media seems to have gotten a little bit wrong in indicating that he was the one who got him released. He didn't. But it was a good opportunity for the governor to come. The press was all there. They were all covering it. The governor was able to talk to them off the cuff there. And it was good for the governor, obviously. As for Ken Lovett, you know, this became so viral that it became international. This reporter, this wonderful reporter who's given the governor a tough time, let's face it, as well as everybody else. I mean, he's a great reporter. He's on WMC all the time, and we think the world of him. And to say the least, he stood tall with these guys. I mean, you know, it can't be that easy when you've got a a guy who is coming on strong and has got a uniform on and all of a sudden is sort of bullying you, and you stand tall and say, I'm not going, not until he goes. It wasn't a nice thing for the Senate. One of the things I worry about in this is who called the play. It could have just been an inexperienced guard, or it well could have been somebody saying, okay, this is our chance. I know that Speaker Hastie in the Assembly said, nothing doing, this isn't right, we allow cell phones here. And by the way, cell phones are allowed in the Senate, because everybody uses them all the time. And this was at a time the Senate wasn't even in session and nobody was in that parlor. So, and it took Flanagan, the chief there, a little while to get his stuff together and issue this kind of an apology.
You mentioned the situation going international, going viral, and it was a great story from Ken on the Capital Connection program. You talked with him this week about him being caught off guard by realizing he had gone viral, including a story about being handcuffed in the police car when his cell phone rang.
That's what's always great about the story. Here's Ken Lovett with his hands handcuffed behind his back for having used his cell phone in the Senate lobby. It's unbelievable. When he gets out, he has no idea that this is now the story of the week, and the entire press corps is out there snapping pictures and making him even more famous than he is. He says that he was in the patrol car. There was a moment when his phone rang, and his editor was on the phone, and he couldn't answer it. He said the first time he couldn't speak to his editor ever.
And his editor already knew that he had been arrested.
It was all over the place.
Legislative Gazette political observer Alan Chartok. You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Giustina. New York Congresswoman Elise Stefanik led a delegation from the North Country to Ottawa, Canada, to discuss cross-border economic concerns. The Legislative Gazette's Pat Bradley has more.
Economic development officials from Clinton, Jefferson, St. Lawrence, and Franklin counties traveled to Ottawa to meet with Canadian officials and counterparts. 21st District Republican Congresswoman Elise Stefanik says the single most important economic issue that was discussed was NAFTA.
It is one of top priorities for me in my district, strengthening NAFTA. If you look at my district, trade is incredibly important for our manufacturing base and for good-paying jobs. In Clinton County, 15% of the workforce go to work for a Canadian company with a U.S. subsidiary. The supply chain oftentimes for our manufacturers has companies on the U.S. side and on the Canadian side. So NAFTA was the top priority. I also raised dairy, which of course is a part of the NAFTA negotiations. We want Canada to open their dairy markets to U.S. dairy products. But trade was the most important part.
Stefanik adds that another important aspect of the trip was meeting new U.S. Ambassador to Canada, Kelly Craft.
Just introducing her to the region, introducing her to the story of the North Country, I think that's important to raise the profile of the economic benefits of our region and what makes us unique.
North Country Chamber of Commerce President and CEO Gary Douglas says the region's greatest driving economic force is the cross-border relationship.
The level of the meetings was extraordinary. We started off the day actually sitting down with Canada's chief NAFTA negotiator. You know, it doesn't get much higher than that. We met with a parliamentary secretary, a very high-level position in the House of Commons. We met with a number of MPs in the Commons who are part of a border caucus that led us to certainly talk about a number of specific border issues, implementation of the pre-clearance agreement, hopefully seeing a revisitation of the Beyond the Border process. A whole lot of things that we were able to talk about. And then the most valuable thing, particularly when they're at this kind of level, is just further relationship building.
Canadian-American Border Trade Alliance President and CEO Jim Phillips says the array of meetings focused on the significance of the U.S.-Canada relationship and the importance of improving and modernizing NAFTA.
This was not a meet-and-greet type day. It was honest, detailed, specific discussion and impact that will have lasting benefit. All the economic development people now personally have met the leader of the Canadian Chamber of Commerce, the leader of the Maritime Commerce of Canada, which is the Great Lakes and the St. Lawrence, which is very important to the Montreal, to Duluth trade. They met these people firsthand. So it was really a benefit to all that attended.
Invitations to visit the North Country were extended and accepted by Ambassador Kraft and by the President of the Canadian Chamber of Commerce.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Pat Bradley.
Remington, which started making flintlock rifles more than 200 years ago, has filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy. The Legislative Gazette's Dave Lucas reports the company has long-standing ties to upstate New York.
Blame for the gunmaker's fall is being cast on a dramatic drop in firearms sales since Donald Trump was elected president. No one is saying what will happen to the 3,500 or so employees at Remington as it reorganizes. Some 900 workers are employed in the Herkimer County Village of Ilion. Mayor Terry Leonard learned of the bankruptcy via email.
It's kind of like the second shoe dropping because this was announced a number of weeks ago that this filing was on its way.
The Madison, North Carolina-based manufacturer laid off 122 workers at the Mohawk Valley plant in March 2017 and another 55 in September. Area State Assemblyman Mark Butler told WAMC at the time,
"This is simply a reaction to a general downturn in the firearms industry."
According to NPR, guns fly off the shelves when a Democratic president occupies the White House. NPR reports gun manufacturers, believing Hillary Clinton would be elected, ramped up production, which turned out to be a bad decision. Butler believed Remington, which manufactured its first flintlock rifle in 1816 in upstate New York, would persevere.
"We have been through that here in the Mohawk Valley and Remington Arms. They're up 100, they're down 200. And every time anything like that happens, you know, it's a bellwether industry. It's a foundation of our economy here. It sends vibrations to every corner of our region. I mean, we have employees, I think they did a survey from 8 or 9 counties that actually come here to work. But I'm convinced, and I've talked to other local officials, we're convinced that there's no master strategy here, that this is simply the result of a reaction to the more general economy."
Mayor Leonard, who worked 20 years for the company, is optimistic.
"I want to remain hopeful that the filing is what it says it is, an opportunity to restructure debt and hold off on some creditors while they continue to operate and reorganize."
The Associated Press cites records released by the Bankruptcy Court of the District of Delaware, which say Remington Outdoor Company agreed to a prepackaged deal that would give holders of the company's $550 million term loan an 82.5% stake. Third lien note holders will take 17.5% of Remington, and four-year warrants get a 15% stake. Remington, which did not return a call for comment to WAMC, has lined up $100 million from lenders to continue operations.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Dave Lucas.
You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. The project to remediate a former baby food factory in New York's Mohawk Valley has received a major boost in state funding. The Legislative Gazette's Lucas Willard explains.
The former beech nut factory in Canajoharie is hard to miss, but the dream that some local officials have to see the 1 million square foot eyesore cleaned up is moving closer to reality. In the fall of 2017, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency gave Montgomery County the go-ahead to address debris piles contaminated with asbestos on a partially demolished portion of the facility. In November, local residents came together to offer ideas to a consulting firm on what to do with the property once it is ready for reuse. Ginny Ogden is a reverend at a local church and a member of a community action group which formed a couple of years ago to plan next steps for the factory property.
Diversity. We definitely wanted something where there was a banquet hall with a commercial kitchen where we could have weddings, we could have community gatherings, we could a multi-purpose room.
The demolition and remediation process, which began last fall, has now received a shot in the arm through a $6 million grant from the state-funded Restore New York Communities Initiative. Canajoharie Mayor Francis Avery said he is elated over the announcement.
We've had the impression for a long time that this has been going on so slowly that we'd really been forgotten. This proves that everyone was sincere, that things will be moving forward, and we are just elated over the whole announcement.
Beechnut moved from its Canajoharie plant to a site in the nearby town of Florida in 2011. New owners came in and failed to pay taxes on the property, which is now empty and rapidly falling into disrepair. Last year, Montgomery County was able to foreclose on the 22-acre property. County Executive Matt Ossenfort believes the $6 million is the largest grant the county has received.
I haven't been able to find an award that's been bigger than this. Certainly, it's a big problem, therefore a big award. But I'm just really proud of the team. You know, for Little Montgomery County, you know, a small rural county in upstate New York, to do a total of about $10.8 million in economic development grants this year, it's just we're proud of the work we're doing, and you're seeing Montgomery County turn around, and you're seeing good projects get off the ground.
Restore New York provided $81 million to projects across the state in 71 communities in its most recent round of funding. Work is currently focused on the partially demolished east side of the property that includes warehouse space, according to Mayor Avery.
Once we do our cleanup, we want to redevelop the east side first, next to the thruway. Then the next steps are going to be decisions on what has to be done with what we refer to as the west side, the office space and the plant itself.
Meanwhile, officials plan to continue putting together a master plan for the project. Again, Matt Ossenfort.
Getting through the demolition is great, but I've said it before, we have the chance to reimagine a downtown in one of the most charming little villages in upstate New York. And that is an opportunity that doesn't come around very often. So we want to make sure we do this right and do something that's going to carry the village of Canajoharie for many years to come and be a boost for the region as well.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Lucas Willard.
And that about does it for this week's show. We had help from the New York State Public Radio Network. For copies, call 1-800-323-9262. That's 1-800-323-9262. Ask for program number 1813, or just listen or podcast on the web at wamc.org. And join us again next week at this same time for more news on New York State government and politics. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm David Gustina.
Statewide distribution for the Legislative Gazette is made possible by New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org.